In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We hear excerpts from a special discussion titled Second Opinion, hosted by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. The senator organized a panel of world-renowned doctors and medical experts to offer another perspective on the engineered pandemic, the current knowledge of early in-hospital treatment, and the efficacy and safety of the experimental shot. We hear first an excerpt from attorney Tom Rentz, who with attorney Lee Dundas revealed to the panel the increase of miscarriages, cancer, and neurological damage related to the experimental shots. This information has been collected in what's known as Project Salus. They show that 71% of new COVID cases and 61% of hospitalizations are from those who've had the experimental shots, misleadingly called vaccines. Let's have a listen.
Apparently one of the whistleblowers is brave enough to come forward and give a name, or I would not have allowed you to come.
Yes, Senator. So we've got three whistleblowers who have given me permission at this point to share their name. Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Teresa Long, DOMPH, Dr. Samuel Sigloff, and Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Peter Chambers, DO and flight surgeon. All three have given me this data. I have declarations from all three. This data is under penalty. This is under penalty of perjury. We intend to submit this to the courts. We have substantial data showing that we saw, for example, miscarriages increased by 300% over the five-year average, almost. We saw almost 300% increase in cancer over the five-year average. Cancer is not being talked about except for by Dr. Ryan Cole. Thank you, doctor. We saw, this one's amazing, neurological. So neurological issues which would affect our pilots, over 1,000% increase.
That's 10 times the rate, and obviously that resonates.
83,000 per year, I'm sorry, 82,000 per year to 863,000 in 1 year. Our soldiers are being experimented on, injured, and sometimes possibly killed. Dr. Corey, thank you so much for your stance on the corruption. That's precisely what it is. They know this, and Senator, when these doctors are attacked, not necessarily the people in this room, I'm not giving names, they call me. I'm the one dealing with the medical boards. I'm the one watching the witch hunts. I'm the one fighting them off, and I'm the one telling them where to go. I'm going to keep doing that. Senator, we also have, let me give you this last thing, and then I'll shut up and get out of your way. 9/28/2021. Project Salus weekly report. Project Salus is a Defense Department initiative where they report and they take all this data that doesn't exist supposedly, and they give it to the CDC. They're watching these vaccines. On that date and around that date, I have numerous instances where Fauci and that entire crew were saying it's a crisis of the unvaxxed. It's 99% unvaxxed in the hospital. In Project Salus, in the weekly report, the DOD document says specifically 71% of new cases are in the fully vaxxed and 60% of hospitalizations are in the fully vaxxed. This is corruption at the highest level. We need investigations. The Secretary of Defense needs investigated. The CDC needs to be investigated. And thank you so much, Senator, for having the courage to stand against these special interests.
So we go now to hear Dr. Peter McCullough, cardiologist and former vice chief of internal medicine at Baylor University Medical Center, talk with Dr. Christina Parks. Dr. Parks received her PhD in cellular and molecular biology from the University of Michigan in 1999, where her research focused on cytokine signaling. Let's have a listen.
How many of you in this room, recognizing there are doctors, there are PhDs, there are attorneys, media experts, other scientists, public citizens, how many of you personally have witnessed censorship, intimidation, or professional reprisal and damage as a result of your advocacy for patients? I want this to be recorded. That is 80% of this room have experienced something negative in their life in trying to promote and help compassionately something positive for patients suffering with a potentially fatal illness. I want to recognize Dr. Christina Parks, and I'm going to ask her to give a few brief comments regarding her experience. Christina Parks is a PhD in cellular molecular biology at the University of Michigan. She's been widely recognized as a leader scientifically in the African-American community. Dr. Parks.
Hi. I just want to clarify, I do not currently work at University of Michigan. That's where I received my degree in cytokine signaling in 1999. Today, I come both as an African-American, as a scientist. As a scientist, it's quite baffling to me that we have an avalanche of data showing that it's the spike protein that causes the deleterious effects of COVID. All right? So, but we don't see any problem with putting genetic material into the cells of our body that tell it to make tons and tons of spike protein. Right? We're not adding a little bit like a traditional vaccine and then having your body make an antibody response. We've decided, let's just make the body just make tons of the spike protein. And we know that the spike protein is toxic. The Ginsha lab at Georgetown showed the spike protein signals through the ACE2 receptor, which usually doesn't signal at all, and that leads to pulmonary hypertension. This is causing inflammation. Evolio and at the Bristol Medical Center in the UK showed that the spike protein severely disrupts the functions of cells that support the heart. Maybe it's just me, but I want my heart cells to work right. Lee and all out of Hong Kong demonstrated the antibodies made to the spike protein cross-react with our own tissues so that many people, when they make antibodies to the spike protein, they're getting an autoimmune response that can be devastating. I could go on and on and on. We know the spike protein is toxic. Why are we having our bodies make it? As an African-American scientist, I'm extremely troubled about this one-size-fits-all approach to vaccination and vaccine mandates. There is now a growing body of data showing that people of African descent respond more vigorously to vaccines containing RNA viruses and may need a lower dose. This is Gregory Poland's work out of the Mayo Clinic, and basically he showed that they have both a higher innate and a higher humoral response. And in order for those vaccines to be safe, we're looking at something like the MMR with measles, mumps, and rubella, all RNA viruses, they may need a lower dose because the higher dose, when you activate your immune system, it becomes inflammatory. If you activate it too much, it becomes hyperinflammatory. If you lack vitamin D, which most African Americans are deficient in, you cannot shut down that inflammation. So this is something that we should have been looking at, and we're not looking at. We have decided to do one size fits all.
Dr. Parks, just to keep it on track, and because we're going to get to the vaccines section
I'm sorry.
In a little bit, but I want your comments just very briefly on African Americans and early treatment, your understanding as a scientist.
We need to have vitamin D. Right, we need to have vitamin D sufficiency. We need to have hydroxychloroquine. Not only is it's anti-inflammatory, but it actually modulates many of the predispositions for diabetes and hypertension that African Americans suffer from. So, regardless of the fact that it's used as to prevent viral replication and things like that, it can actually modulate the predispositions. And so why wouldn't you want to give it in order to stabilize things like blood sugar levels and in order to stabilize inflammation?
Very specifically, African-Americans have double the mortality of non-African-Americans, and the mortalities all happen in the hospital. Are African-Americans, are they denied early treatment in the community?
Well, yes, they are. My dad just died. Right? He died Friday. Couldn't get a test. Couldn't get monoclonal antibodies. We treated him at home. Unfortunately, we had an oxygen machine that didn't work. So his blood saturation went down to the point where he was incoherent. We called the EMS. They said, your problem is your oxygen machine doesn't work. They put oxygen on him. He went to 98% saturation. We moved him to the hospital. He recovered all his cognitive functions. He was doing quite well. But he was no longer getting medications that reduce his inflammation. He was no longer getting medications that blocked the histamine response. He was no longer getting the medications that he needed, and he was no longer getting lung steroids. He just declined and declined and declined until he passed away on Friday, and I say he passed away from lack of appropriate care.
Thank you.
Did you have no right to insist that your father was treated as a practicing physician?
I'm not a physician. I'm a PhD.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. So, but you had no right as a family member.
No, they said these are our protocols, and this is all we'll do. I mean, we asked for those things specifically. In my father's case, things went fairly quickly. First, they told us we'll send him home tomorrow with oxygen. Then they changed their story, and we asked for particular medications, and they said those weren't part of their protocol. They could not give them to us.
Well, we are deeply sorry, and even more deeply sorry the fact that yours isn't the only story I've heard like that. I've heard countless stories. But Dr. McCullough.
There may be 800,000 stories like this.
We now hear part of this five-hour panel. We begin hearing from Dr. Ryan Cole.
Remdesivir, that is not creative. Neither is molnupiravir. I cannot say that enough. It is not a creative thing. The drugs we were talking about are wonder drugs. They really are. Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, cypraheptadine, Pepcid. There's a whole list. I've got a... I won't go through them, but there's a lot of things we can use. They're incredibly safe, and you can save lives. We've had people save lives without hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. There's a doctor from South Africa named Dr. Shetty. We all know he saved over 7,000 people without using any of those drugs.
So I guess my chart's been banned by my staff as well. But let me just quick summarize it for you, because it just points out in very stark terms the safety profile of some of these repurposed drugs versus... you know, what we're seeing through the VAERS report with the vaccine. Ivermectin, over 26 years, on average about 15 deaths per year reported in associated with it. Again, VAERS and FAERS, this is how FAERS does not prove causation. So 15 deaths per year on average. Hydroxychloroquine, 69 deaths per year over 26 years. The flu vaccine, about 77 deaths, I think it is. 77. It is that. Oh, great. It wasn't banned.
You're hitting
it. Yeah, no, I'm an accountant. I remember numbers. But you take a look at remdesivir. It's over 1,600 deaths since it got its emergency use authorization. And now, unfortunately, with the COVID vaccine, 22,000 deaths reported on VAERS. Again, we all recognize VAERS does not prove causation, but 30% of those 22,000 deaths occurred on days 0, 1, or 2. It certainly raises alarms to me. I don't understand why it hasn't raised alarms to the FDA. And so I want to go back over to, because it's on the same subject, Dr. Wiseman, one of the first things I really recognized in terms of things you had done is your video you put together in terms of the advisory committee meeting on molnupiravir. And very quickly, again, let's not get too far down the weeds, that advisory committee barely recommended it. It was a vote 13 to 10. Can you just hit on the... And again, I personally hope that molnupiravir, Paxlovid work beautifully. I mean, anything. I will embrace anything. I am completely agnostic when it comes to whatever drug will end this pandemic. Vaccine, whatever. I don't care. I want this pandemic over. I want people to live. But just talk a little bit about molnupiravir in terms of that study, and if you've got something on Paxlovid, because I know you've also done some work on Paxlovid too, but again, succinctly.
Okay, so thank you. I would encourage everyone to watch that AMBAC meeting. AMBAC is the committee for the FDA that deals with antimicrobial drugs, because that, to me, is the closest to any real discussion of safety and efficacy of any of the agents that we've been talking about. And what's remarkable to me is that it hasn't been repeated. It wasn't repeated with Paxlovid, and it wasn't prequelled with the vaccines. But in that meeting, you had very, very good discussion among top FDA toxicology people who expressed serious concerns about molnupiravir. And amazingly, Paxlovid didn't go through the same procedure afterwards.
Concerns about molnupiravir were...
Okay, so the main concern of molnupiravir is that its stated mechanism of action is to induce mutagenesis. It's to make a storm of mutations so much that it discombobulates, you know,
what could go wrong there? The solution of that problem, which Merck was asked and they had no answer for, As I recall, the solution was we're going to make sure that everybody stays quarantined on molnupiravir.
Yeah, but
and they were going to take the full dose. So this is where I want to start transitioning into, Dr. McCulloch, what we've talked to in the past. Because you were calling for, you know what they're called, these independent safety review panels. Or I mean, you've got the exact name for it. Talk about, as Dr. Wiseman just did, talk about what we didn't do in the approval process, in the safety surveillance, the follow-up process. Talk about the steps we didn't take that we should have and what we ought to be doing moving forward.
And my comments will be regarding the COVID-19 vaccine. So Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson. I have served on or chaired over 24 data safety monitoring boards for NIH-sponsored and Big Pharma-sponsored clinical trials. I know data safety inside out, backwards and forwards. I've also been on critical event committees, and I've been on institutional review boards. Those three bodies are essential. I'll repeat, a critical event committee to adjudicate a safety event, a data safety monitoring board to independently look at what is going on with a clinical program and when an investigational product is being administered, and then a human ethics board to understand and help protect the subjects in that study. We have an Office of Human Research Protections here in the United States, OHRP. They are charged in protecting human subjects. Our COVID-19 vaccines, the consent form indicates in every state in the United States that the vaccines are investigational or in research because they are emergency use authorization. What did not happen is we did not have those three essential bodies of independent people installed. We never had those. By the way, they were installed and were utilized in the randomized clinical trials before they came to EUA approval. We also had the wrong bodies leading the vaccine program. Remember, the FDA is supposed to be the safety watchdog. The National Institutes of Health is the government research body, and the CDC is the outbreak investigation body. Right now, the CDC and the FDA are the named sponsors of a vaccine program. If American can learn anything, we should never have the FDA and CDC be a sponsor of a public program in administering a product. It has been a giant and colossal mistake. We should have had a separate body, a government body, be the sponsor of the vaccine program. The vaccine manufacturers can supply the products, and then we needed the separate data safety monitoring board, clinical event committee, and human ethics committee there in oversight. And if this would have happened based on the emergence of unexplained deaths, I am testifying today that the program would have been shut down in February because of excess mortality.
Specifically, the NIAID division of the NIH co-owns the patent on the Moderna vaccine, and six members of the NIAID get royalties from the profits into their personal pockets, not to mention the entire budget of that program.
Are you sure of that?
I'm sure of that.
That's
publicly available information.
Four
members get royalties.
I know there's also an issue, there's also an issue of the people that on the panel for remdesivir had some kind of tie with Gilead as well.
Rife with conflicts of interest that would never be accepted in other settings. NIH, just for people out there that don't know where these agencies are situated in the federal government, NIH, which has gotten involved in sponsoring the research, the studies, for approval of the vaccines, FDA, which is the agency that gives approval, and CDC, which is the agency that makes recommendations on which subsequent mandates are based. So the CDC says, well, we don't mandate anything. We don't make federal policy, federal law, which is true, right? But all the mandates then look to the CDC recommendations as their justification. So nobody ultimately takes responsibility for the mandates. There's no place where the buck stops. All of these are divisions of the same Department of Health and Human Services. They all report to the same secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. And the need for strict separation from those who are profiting from these products, right, which is what we expect corporations to do. Of course, that's what they're about. But all the more need for careful structures to be put in place such that the regulatory agencies are serving the interests of the American people.
Then there's also a revolving door between the agencies and the pharma.
Exactly.
And I won't name any names, but we've seen it in the
You can trace their careers as they rotate through these agencies into pharma and back.
So let me transition. Dr. McCulloch talked about the CDC, NIH, FDA kind of not playing the roles they should have played. What about the health agencies in general dictating how doctors practice medicine and how foreign that really should be to how the structure is set up?
Okay.
And why is that? I mean, I realize, you know, $140 billion worth of grant money flowing through Dr. Fauci over decades. So talk a little bit about what has happened to
one more comment on that. Yeah. I received a letter from the California State Medical Board maybe 6 months ago. Went out to all physicians from the medical board saying, any physician in California who writes an inappropriate exemption for masks or other COVID-related measures will have his medical license subjected to investigation and disciplinary action. So for a physician, just to help you to understand, this kind of threat hanging over your head is worse than the threat of getting fired. If I get fired from a particular healthcare organization, I can go to another healthcare organization or go start a private practice. If I lose my medical license, I cannot practice medicine. Okay? That's how serious this is. The letter never defined what might constitute an appropriate or inappropriate mask mandate. So I have no idea if I write a mandate for a kid with a severe anxiety disorder that's worsened by the wearing of a mask, is that going to subject my medical license to disciplinary action? Physicians in California interpreted the phrase and other COVID-related measures to include vaccines, which had already been rolled out at that point. It has become de facto impossible to get a medical exemption for a COVID vaccine in the state of California. No physician will write them, even when you have someone that has a contraindication listed on the CDC's list of contraindications to COVID vaccines. I have a patient, went to her rheumatologist, specialist in her autoimmune condition. This specialist told this patient, I don't think you should get the COVID vaccines, given your age, your low risk of COVID, and I think there's a good chance that these vaccines, based on the data that we have, could worsen your underlying medical condition. She turned to the same physician immediately afterwards and said, can you write me, therefore, a medical exemption? Because I need one for work. There's a vaccine mandate at work. Same physician that just told her not to take the vaccine or recommended against it said, no, I'm sorry, I can't write you a medical exemption because I'm afraid I might lose my license.
Are you telling me that patients who have known life-threatening contraindications receive a COVID-19 vaccine indeed are not being given exemptions?
So the medical boards are behaving very irresponsibly, doing the bidding of governors who want to impose certain mandates, in this case, mask mandates or vaccine mandates. They're not serving the public good. In this case, they are not certainly not serving the interests of patients. And they are, again, in my entire 18 years of being a licensed physician, I and my colleagues have never, ever received any kind of communication like this from the medical board. It's outlandish.
And to your point, Dr. Cariotti, they never define.
Exactly.
They threaten you, and it's this looming threat without definition. You're spreading misinformation. Oh, do cite the papers in which I am spreading misinformation. They will not define it. They will attack you. They will threaten you. They will put you in a state of fear and say, you can only do what we say, but don't save a life. And by the way, the vaccines are expired because Omicron is here. And now they still want to mandate them. So they threaten us and threaten us and threaten us, and we're hunted for caring and being compassionate and empathetic and wanting to help humanity.
I want to correct one thing that Dr. Chiariti said, which is there is one physician in California who will write a medical exemption and a mask exemption. There is one physician. I found him.
I wouldn't name him.
Yeah. So, believe me, he doesn't want to be named.
Yeah,
but he is being investigated.
Okay, so a little ahead of schedule. I see Breanne Dressen is been somewhat the spokesperson for some of the individuals that have been experienced injuries. So, Brianne, why don't you two introduce yourself? For some reason, you wanted to address this issue.
I'm Brianne Dressen. I participated in the clinical trial for AstraZeneca here in the United States last November. I experienced an extreme reaction that has changed my life. Even though I am sitting here before you today, I feel like I'm being electrocuted 24/7, and I can eat about six things, and my body feels like it's made of glass. Yes, so I was hospitalized. I was paralyzed from the waist down. I was incontinent, and because of this, because I cried while I was in the ER when my legs weren't working, I was diagnosed with anxiety. So I was sent home with intensive physical and occupational therapy due to anxiety due to the COVID vaccine. But I was later able to go to the NIH and receive appropriate diagnoses after 7 months, neuropathy, POTS, things that are not anxiety.
Yeah, and my name's Kyle Warner. I'm a professional athlete, mountain bike racer, and I was injured by the Pfizer vaccine with my second dose. I developed the heart inflammation, POTS, and then a little bit of mast cell activation syndrome, which has also made it so I have limited things I can eat without just a big inflammation cascade. I've also asked my primary care physician for an exemption four times. She's not able to write me an exemption. I live in Boise, Idaho, and yeah, the St. Al's Network there basically told her, under no circumstance are you allowed to get an exemption. I'm worried about traveling for my job in the future. I'm not going to get a booster, because if I do, I'm worried I'll have an issue. And one of my questions to the panel, too, is there a standardized exemption form out there now where people who do get an exemption can travel around the world? Because if I show up at the Canadian border with just a doctor's note, will that be good enough?
We saw what happened in Australia with the world's number one tennis player who had a medical exemption that was supposedly accepted by the tennis association that he was a part of, but the government entirely in a completely arbitrary fashion, and to make an example out of this high-profile athlete, denied that same medical exemption. So unfortunately, there is not a uniform standard to acknowledge that some people should not get a particular intervention. There is no medication that is good for everyone all the time in all circumstances. It's an absurd notion.
And there's no product that's safe for everyone.
That's correct.
At all times. And there were large numbers of individuals excluded from the clinical trials based upon concerns and appropriate concerns of safety, including pregnant women, women of childbearing potential who could not guarantee contraception, COVID-recovered, suspected COVID-recovered, and those with positive serologies, because the FDA and Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, outside the United States, AstraZeneca, knew that these individuals, the products would either not be safe or not be efficacious, and the institutional review boards and the FDA who reviewed these protocols also agreed. In order to exclude a group from a clinical trial, the justification must be very strong. It is regulatory practice and principle, always, that groups that are excluded from randomized registrational trials are always excluded and contraindicated from the administration of the product in clinical practice, particularly during the early adoption and early experience part of the program. Without exception, we carry this forward. The observation and the fact that the FDA and the CDC abrogated those regulatory principles and encourage actively and through many mechanisms had others actually coerce individuals for whom the vaccine is unsafe to receive the vaccine and then incur fatal and non-fatal injuries is, at this point in time, malfeasance. It's wrongdoing by those in positions of regulatory authority.
And there is no stronger or clearer contraindication to a vaccine or a medication than having already been harmed by it. Mm-hmm. So being subjected to have to take something again that has already harmed you in order to live, in order to travel, in order to work professionally is criminal.
Yeah.
Corey wants to say something.
That was just one of my questions, too. Is it, you know, logical to think that if you've been harmed by the first dose, then you shouldn't get a second dose? And if you get the second dose and you're harmed, would the booster potentially do more harm? And if you were on the seventh booster, would that potentially cause more harm?
Of course. You don't have to be a physician to know the answer to that question. A four-year-old knows the answer to that question.
And I just want to partner off of what Dr. McCullough said. I don't think people realize that all these people who had COVID were excluded from the trials, all of them. So we're going to take our 5 to 11-year-olds, that there's 28 million. That means 14, it was about half and half. It's probably more 60% have had COVID already. So let's say 12 million have had not had COVID. So if those 12 million had the vaccine and it was a perfect vaccine, it's 0.1 per 100,000, we might sell 12 children. What's going to happen to the 16 million children who've already had the virus, who already have immunity, and we're going to subject them to something that wasn't even tested in that group? It's literally absurd. And that's the thing I would say, Senator, is that we're not here about civil liberties and mandates. We're here to save lives. And this group of people should be excluded, absolutely. There's an Achilles heel to the program of natural immunity. Natural immunity denial should not be happening. It should be a major focus of what we're trying to do here, because you're going to harm, I don't know how many children, by force vaccinating 16 million children. It's absurd.
I'm sorry to have to do this. I feel like a broken record. But I'm listening to my colleagues call out all of the inanities, the insanities, the absurdities, okay, these departures of our policies from what we know are to be scientific truths. It's things like denial of natural immunity. We have to understand why. To sit here and point fingers and they're doing this wrong and that wrong, why are they doing this? There could be multiple reasons. The simplest and most easily understandable and provable is every vaccine, every of these you know, these novel patented high-cost drugs is profits. They are putting profits ahead of patients. You know, we can call attention to all of these policies. They are non-scientific. They're failing at having scientific support, yet they're being carried out and they're being distributed across the country. And doctors and states and health departments are willingly accepting these without question, without critical thinking. And that's what I want us to be clear that we're calling attention to today. This is corruption, plain and simple. It's corruption. Sorry.
I want to echo Dr. Corey's statement and say that it didn't start now. Many people have been fighting this corruption for many years. When they did the 1986 Vaccine Injury Act and said that manufacturers no longer have liability for any vaccine that's on the childhood schedule, the childhood schedule exploded. Now, I'm not saying every vaccine is or isn't safe on that schedule, but I'm saying that's when they said, we have the perfect business model. Every kid has to take these vaccines if we put it on the schedule, and we have no liability. And so the schedule exploded, and safety corners were cut because we have no liability. And suddenly we started to see you have to have HPV for school. You have to have this for school. You have to have that for school. And so this business model, the more they pushed it, the more they realized no one pushed back because of this sort of idea that vaccines were always, always a positive health intervention. And so now we've gotten to the point where the mass formation psychosis around vaccines always being a positive health intervention has gotten us here. And so we have to look at that aspect. Why are they vaccinating our children? Because once it's on the vaccine, once it's on the childhood schedule, they are no longer liable for injury. So they're going to get off that EUA, put it right on the childhood vaccine schedule, and then have no liability going forward.
So let me just enter a little data into this. Because we hear, you know, infection fatality rates, and we hear these infinitesimally small percentages. I turn those into numbers that I think are understandable, and they're actually quite shocking. Okay, this is CDC's numbers, and then John Ioannidis in Stanford, his numbers as well. They just got published. But again, we're talking about medical necessity and the stratification of the risk that we've completely ignored. And this puts in, I think, sharp focus of why we shouldn't have ignored medical necessity and the stratification of risk as it relates to COVID in general. So, according to the CDC, the best numbers we have, if you're from 0 to 17 years of age, About 20 of you will die from COVID per million. 20 per million, 20, 20. If you're older than 65, 90,000 of you may die from COVID per million. Okay, so over the 65, 90,000 per million versus 0 to 17, 20 per million. John Ioannidis' numbers are somewhat similar as stark. 0 to 19, different age categories. 0 to 19, about 13 deaths per million. Over 70, 40,000 deaths. So where should have our response been focused? With children? Should we even, and let's face it, nobody can tell you the long-term safety profile of these vaccines. Nobody. It's unknowable because we haven't taken the time. Nobody knows. Again, my band chart would indicate I ought to have a little concern. With that lack of knowledge, it probably would indicate you ought to use some caution, but we haven't. Before I just have to read you a quick little news story out of Vietnam. Just got this today. A ninth grader in the northern province of Phu Tho died Tuesday after getting her second Pfizer vaccine dose, the local medical center said Thursday. The girl had gotten her first Pfizer dose on December 3rd, 2021, after which she experienced dizziness and had difficulty breathing. She was taken to a medical center for treatment and later recovered. She had her second dose last Monday. Her mother told healthcare workers about the girl's side effects following her first shot, but they asked her to get the second shot anyway. Again, this is a ninth grader. Doesn't have much risk from COVID. Has a reaction to the first dose, but let's give her the second dose anyway. 20 minutes following the second shot, the girl experienced tightness in her chest, dizziness, difficulty in breathing, and seizures. She received emergency treatment on the spot before being transferred to a district medical center. On arrival, she began to vomit blood, fell into a coma, and her heart stopped. Her family received news that she died Tuesday morning. Now, I guess this isn't evidence that a death might be related to the vaccine, but it certainly would concern me more than it's concerned Dr. Fauci, Dr. Lewinsky, Dr. Collins, Dr. Woodcock, Dr. Marks. I know one of your favorites, Brian. This is reality. This is a reality that's being ignored by our federal health officials, by the legacy media, by big tech. Dr. Merrick.
So, kids are 1,000 times more likely to die from a bicycle than from COVID. So I think it would be appropriate that the federal government ban all bicycles, because they're certainly more likely to kill you than COVID.
Thank you, Senator. So it's we all feel good when we say these anecdotes, and I appreciate the humor. We need humor to defend. But Senator Johnson, I'd like to touch on a couple of things. Regarding the age stratification, I was asked not to speak about this by Nancy Pelosi's office, but I had a meeting with them last fall, and I specifically asked that they ask the CDC to age stratify, and there was absolutely no action taken. So it's not as if the administration and the senior leadership in the House, at least, was not aware of this issue of age stratification. Point number two, the issue of the vaccines and the vaccine mandates. The data are clear. The vaccines are not protecting from infection, replication, and spread of Omicron, and the data are relatively clear and emerging that vaccination is enhancing the risk of infection, replication, disease, and spread of Omicron. There's no logic.
Let me just quick stop you. Can you talk a little bit about the studies that are proving that? Because, you know, we've all been accused of spreading misinformation, okay? Disinformation. Can you?
The Ontario data, Robert, those lines crossed a couple of weeks ago. So in Ontario, Canada's highly vaccinated region, their public health data has shown for several weeks higher numbers of Omicron cases in the vaccinated as compared to the unvaccinated. And the response to that was always, yeah, but a higher proportion of the population is vaccinated, so we would expect to see maybe more breakthrough cases. But just, I think, about 2 weeks ago, if you look at cases per 100,000, so not total number of cases, but case rates, the vaccinated group was on a steeper incline, if you look at the curves. And those lines crossed about, 9 or 10 days ago, I think it was, where cases per 100,000 in Ontario, Canada, highly vaccinated region, are higher among the vaccinated than among the unvaccinated. I think it's an open and debatable question whether and to what extent the vaccines are still protecting against more severe symptoms. But in terms of cases, there's more cases now and higher case rates.
So Ontario is one example. There's multiple examples from Northern Europe. There's examples from Scotland and the United Kingdom. And now I'm being asked to consult with the president of Israel tonight regarding what they're seeing there, where they've seen the third jab and the fourth jab are not helping.
So what would be the physiology? I realize you don't know this, but why would that be? I mean, why? Because, being part of the doctors' groups, I've heard doctors talk about this vaccine may misset your or inadequately set your immune system and maybe make you more vulnerable. I mean, I think there is documented case that there's a spike in COVID cases right after the first dose. Where maybe, you know, what's happening?
So, Senator Johnson, you're exactly right. And we call this confounding variables. And it's very difficult because there's so many overlapping things. Dr. Risch can speak eloquently, I'm sure, about the challenges of confounding in these large data sets. And we always have to be very cautious. But what we're seeing is a risk profile that is a function of the number of vaccine doses. So you're seeing increased risk with one relative to none, and increased with two relative to one, and with three relative to two.
And why would that possibly? Why can you? Can you? So I told you guys not to speculate.
One reason.
Can you speculate?
One reason might be is because when they gave the mRNA vaccines, which are a form of gene therapy, it induces a very inflammatory response. They wanted to tamp down on that to prevent hyperinflammation upon vaccination, and so they modified the RNA in a way that changed the way that it interacted with our toll-like receptors. Our toll-like receptors are receptors that we have that basically take things like viruses, bacteria, and they coordinate an inflammatory response. And by coordinate, it's not a simple response. It's many different toll-like receptors integrating a large body of data and telling your body what to do. So it's important that they are recognizing the right molecule, getting that danger signal, and integrating the response. But we engineered these virus-like particles to tone down their response. And so now we have basically, there was a paper that came out, and maybe Dr. Cole has the reference for that, but that basically it's basically changing the whole way the immune system works. So it's no longer as responsive to viruses, no longer as responsive to bacteria and many other pathogens, because we've sort of like turned them off or turned them down.
And that was Dr. Foss's study out of the Netherlands.
So we may be getting some disagreements, which is fine. Okay, I don't know what's
I'm supporting her data. Yeah.
I've opened up a can of worms, I can tell.
That's some new data. It's somewhat speculative, but that would explain some of the dose response if you keep turning off those toll-like receptors. And it would also, some of the anecdotal evidence that there may be more cancers because that's a surveillance. You're turning off that surveillance.
But if I may,
We're trying to do this for a layman audience, and again, I'm trying to say, now, this is, I did ask people to speculate, and that's dangerous, and I could be opening up a can of worms here, but I think this is an important discussion, but try and communicate it in a way that...
There's four or five different mechanisms, potential deep scientific mechanisms that range from suppressing your immune system to changing the behavior of people that are interacting with their environment. There's a range of potential confounding variables. We don't need to go there right now, but the FDA absolutely and my colleagues in vaccinology have long known that one of the great risks, one of the things that scares us most as vaccinologists, is vaccine-enhanced disease. And there's a long history of vaccine-enhanced disease examples over time. Respiratory syncytial virus is the one that's often cited by my fellow vaccinologists, but there's many others. This is why we have to be careful in developing new vaccines. It's one example of why we have to be so careful and we have to be cautious about rolling them out and that we do the science. But in the case of vaccine-enhanced disease with coronavirus vaccines, this is a known complication. It's one of the reasons why I advised my group not to pursue vaccines when we got the call from Wuhan in January of 2020. Vaccine-enhanced diseases with coronaviruses has long been a problem. It has compromised every prior coronavirus vaccine development effort. It is including the veterinary ones. It's been overcome twice with licensed veterinary vaccines, and both of those are mucosal vaccines. So in short, this is a known problem. Many of us that are down in the trenches have been carefully monitoring for whether or not there are data emerging that suggests this problem might be occurring. And now we seem to be seeing clinical data that's consistent with that. But as Dr. Risch, I'm sure, will share, we have to be cautious because there are multiple confounding variables.
Well, no, actually, the Public Health UK has actually published a statement about this in their week 42 weekly report that showed that people who've had COVID and then get vaccinated have lower levels of anti-nucleocapsid antibodies. And this means, and since the vaccines don't address the nucleocapsid antigens, they only address the spike, it means that they're doing something that's damaging the immune response in a more general way than just what they do with the spike. And this is empirical data that Public Health UK has published. So we know that this is happening. It's not a theoretical issue about all of the niceties of laboratory biology and virology of things that could happen. It's a real thing that's been really observed by their testing.
This, by the way, is the kind of discussion that ought to be occurring within these advisory panels. Again, it's difficult for the general public to really understand because I don't know exactly.
Senator, we have raised this in front of advisory panels. I've raised it in front of the Israeli Ministry of Health. But we've submitted written documents to CDC and FDA and all these issues and all this this stuff about negative efficacy.
But they've been ignored.
But yeah. David, I want to point out that the CDC and academic medical centers will say, and they will go to a home base, that they will say that the vaccines are associated with a reduction in hospitalization. And this will come up. The CDC in the last few days said there's 5 more papers showing the vaccines, even with Omicron, are associated with a reduction in hospitalization. But it's only in U.S. hospitals, not in South Africa, not right. in Germany, not in Denmark, not in the U.K., and not in Israel. Americans should be asking the question, why are the vaccines only working against hospitalization, but they don't work against binary occurrence of the respiratory illness or reduced spread, and they don't reduce mortality, but why do they only reduce hospitalization? And by the way, they reduce hospitalization in most studies in the United States by 85%. How does that happen? That is basically academic fraud. And the reason why it is because these hospitalizations are not adjudicated. They're not telling us why the patients are hospitalized. And we've had multiple officials come out and tell us that 40 to 60% of people coming to the hospital who test positive for COVID are not there for COVID. Yeah. So we have a trumped up set of numbers. And to make matters worse, our CDC has advised consistently that the unvaccinated get lots of testing and the vaccinated actually refrain from testing. So the combination of not adjudicating hospitalizations and this asymmetric testing is creating a fraudulent data scheme in order to make the claim that the vaccinations are associated with reductions in hospitalizations when, in fact, they're not. And that's the reason why Israel is loaded with fully vaccinated people in the hospital with COVID-19, and so is Germany, and so is the United Kingdom and elsewhere in the United States.
Senator
Johnson.
I was talking to Dr. Corey about this, who has some experience in hospitals. You were talking to me about the information system in hospitals as relates to vaccinated status. Can you kind of talk about that?
Yeah, so you know, this constant refrain that Dr. McCullough just pointed out to is that everyone in the hospitals is unvaccinated. I believe that is manipulated data, and it's done, again, for the same purpose that I keep talking about. They want to vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. Every vaccine brings profits. Now, how do they do that? In this country, when you log in to the most popular electronic health record, which is probably Epic, and I've been in numbers of hospitals throughout the pandemic, there's only two statuses a patient can have. They can either be vaccinated or they can be unknown. There is no category of unvaccinated. It's unknown. And it is my hypothesis. I cannot prove this. I believe that if you've been vaccinated within that hospital or hospital system, that vaccination record appears. If you went to a Walgreens or a Rite Aid or some private practice, I think it's highly likely it doesn't appear that you're vaccinated. I believe that they are artificially, with great purpose, they are hiding the fact that many people in American hospitals are vaccinated. Because Dr. McCullough just talked about why in the United States is the data here completely discordant from other countries and other health systems, which are revealing the underlying granular public health data in a transparent fashion.
Pierre, I have the answer here. Here's a paper. I'm going to read the title of the paper. The Food and Drug Administration Biologics Effectiveness and Safety Initiative facilitates detection of vaccine administration from unstructured data in medical records through natural language processing. What this is a paper from FDA that just came out in the last week or so. They're saying they've gone through and they've said that there's at least a 16% non-capture of people who were vaccinated but are being called unvaccinated. That is exactly what you're saying. FDA are admitting it. Here's the paper. It's right over here. This is on the top of my list. What are the consequences of that? That means that all the data where they look at vaccinated here and unvaccinated here, you've got 16% who are wrong in the wrong place. That means you've got a 32% imbalance is swinging the wrong way. FDA have just admitted that.
Yeah. That I am absolutely exhausted about hearing about vaccinated and unvaccinated. There's only one category you need to care about. It's untreated versus treated. Stop with the vaccinations.
Okay.
On the
okay. Because we mentioned hospitals, I can get this back on track to, because we really jumped ahead to vaccines, and we got hours to talk about vaccine efficacy, safety, all type of thing. I want to polish off hospital care, because I think it's extremely important. It certainly, as I'm hearing from people, some of those heart-wrenching stories I'm hearing, where a loved one's in the hospital, the family's begging the hospital to do more, trying to save the person's life. And they're just being told, now your loved one, there's not much hope. You know, get ready for the worst, and they just won't do anything. So I want to start the question out. What freedoms do you give up when you get admitted to the hospital? And is this a new phenomenon, or has this always been true? Because it seems like when you hear, you know, Dr. Corey's well aware of this, because he's involved in the lawsuits of families taking hospitals to court to administer, you know, one of the unnameable drugs, and even under court order, the hospitals won't do it, and the people just die. You know, I am the champion, I am the author, I'm the champion of right to try legislation, which gives patients and their doctors the right to try an unapproved drug. And yet, Americans haven't been able to access fully approved drugs with decades of safety profile. What has gone off the rail here? But so, again, I want you hospitalists here, you know, the people that actually probably misusing the term, has this always been the case? Have you always lost all your freedom?
Physicians have always appropriately been granted discretionary latitude to exercise their own medical judgment. There are treatment recommendations from medical societies, from CDC, from all kinds of different sources that we can take into account when treating our patients. But every patient is a new textbook. Every patient is a unique human being that has unique factors that only we and the patient really understand with sufficient depth to make difficult medical judgments. And this is the first time in my career, I think the other clinical physicians in the room would agree, where I've worried, is somebody going to be looking over my shoulder asking me why I've prescribe fluvoxamine for this indication rather than that indication. I prescribe it for depression, no problem. Are you giving this to treat COVID? Why should it matter to you?
But so you're saying this is the first time in your...
Yeah, the last 2 years.
Is that true?
The last 2 years. Now, there are things that hospital administrators do that have annoyed physicians for years. But the kind of hamstringing of physicians in terms of doing what we believe to be the right and best and good for this vulnerable patient in front of me right now, that is my only responsibility as a physician, this patient who has placed their trust in me as their physician to do what is best for them and not be acting as the agent of a social program or a state program or any other interest that could compromise.
So talk about the historic role of these agencies. Yep. And the relationship to doctors, and how did that change? And let's leave the pharmaceutical company capture of these things out of the equation here.
They are advisory, and the CDC is not the nation's super doctor. And I'm going to scandalize a lot of people by saying the CDC is not a medical organization. It's a public health organization focused on infectious disease spread. And they can do modeling, they can do epidemiology, they can give, obviously, recommendations on that issue. But in terms of how to best treat this particular patient in front of me, they are not the experts. The CDC published a list of contraindications to vaccines that has been taken by healthcare institutions to be complete and definitive. The CDC never meant and would openly acknowledge this is not a comprehensive list of reasons to avoid the vaccine.
Isn't it true that health agencies should be working for the doctors? They should be providing you information. They shouldn't be dictating. They're supportive of
yes.
your...
Yeah. And that's a two-way street. They should be listening to doctors, the doctors on the front lines that see firsthand what's going on, that gain valuable clinical experience as things that were tested in highly controlled settings with smaller numbers of patients are put out to broader numbers of patients. These agencies need that feedback from frontline physicians. So it has to be a relationship of mutuality. And ultimately, all the work has to be for the benefit of the patient. Economic, financial, and other perverse incentives and other interests cannot play a role in these deliberations.
That was part of the 5-hour Second Opinion panel organized by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.